You thought that this was just another podcast. You thought a show like this could never last. Well, tell me, who's laughing now? Probably you, 'cause I am so funny. The show is never gonna make money. It's called Josh Figures It Out.
Yeah, Josh Figures It Out, episode 11. What's gup, guys? I just said what's gup. What is gup? Maybe it's short for guppy. Sup, gup? That's what all the fish friends would say to Guppy as he's swimming around. Sup, Gup? Gup is the man. So yeah, still have no theme song, so I'm still singing every week to start this thing out. Have you guys been watching Rick and Morty, by the way, over on Adult Swim? If you're not, you really should. It is the heir apparent to Futurama, as far as I can tell. If you want to see fun animation paired with some ridiculously high-concept sci-fi storytelling, Rick and Morty, check it out. Anyway, that's where I got the inspiration for Baker Street. If you don't get it, watch the show. Anyways, listen to how I sound. Listen to this. It's no MacBook Pro microphone. You were listening to me talk into a Heil PR40. H-E-I-L. I guess it's pronounced Heil. Kind of like Heil Hitler, which is a little disturbing. Did I buy Nazi microphones by accident? Are there, like, anti-Jew devices in here that I should know about? It's going to detect, like, the Jewish caliber of my voice and explode on me or something. I hope not. Man, some mics and some shock mounts and some booms and a Mackie mixer with effects on it? After a little bit of investment and a little bit of help from my dad, thank you very much, Dad, have started to put together a home studio, which is awesome. I've got the mixer I got. This is a serious mixer. This is like a 12-channel mixer here. I think there's effects on this thing, too. I mean, this is a no voice alterification machine, but there's like 24 presets on this thing. What does this do when I turn this up? Reverb. 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 Or what about this? Does it bother you guys if I have this preset on the whole time? What if I turn it way up? Or this is a nice one. I always like having a little delay. I just made a fake delay sound effect with real delay on it. Now, the sad, ironic thing here is I can't actually hear the effects I just did to my voice. Because I made a mistake when setting up the studio. I forgot to buy headphones. The most obvious thing. So, the studio is still very much a work in progress. I've only got two mics, and I don't have any insulating sound blankets yet. I'm currently recording this at my Nana and Papa's house in Cheviot Hills, California. I'm spending the next couple of weeks here because I'm watching their dog, Abby, while they're away on a cruise. And in many ways, it's a beautiful house. It's a nice, quiet house. It's kind of a perfect place to record a podcast like this. On a normal day, I, however, did not know that they film the, I believe, ABC sitcom The Goldbergs here in Cheviot Hills. Probably because it is kind of a time warp here. It's like the platonic ideal of a suburb. I love this neighborhood, you know. I lived here for a couple years in high school. I kind of grew up here. I spent a lot of time here as a kid. It's a beautiful neighborhood. But usually there are not a million catering trucks and cement mixers and crap driving by. It's usually a lot more quiet than this, so there's probably going to be some background noise, and because I don't have the insulating sound blankets yet, you might hear a little bit of that. Of course, if I decided to go record this over at my house in Hollywood, which is right by the Kodak Theater, where Hollywood Boulevard is closed off, and there's helicopters constantly in preparation for the Oscars happening this weekend, which we will talk more about in a few minutes. point is, for right now, I'm still searching for that holy grail of my own quiet personal recording spot. Hasn't quite happened yet. It is indeed a work in progress. As it turned out, I got this set up just in time to hopefully record this thing today, edit it tonight, get it out tomorrow, because I care about you guys and I care about making your Wednesdays that much better, that much. I mean, I could put it out on Thursday, make your Thursdays better, but Wednesdays, I think Wednesday is the day you really need it. Wednesday, it's hump day. You got to get over that hump. How are you going to do it without a little Josh in the morning? You've been working for 2 days, and those 2 days have already probably taken a lot out of you, and you've got, and you're looking at three more days in your week, and you're thinking, how am I going to get through this? And I'm here to tell you, look on the bright side, guys. At least you have a job. But, psh, yeah! So next week, I will have my first guest in this studio. In the meantime, it's just you and me hanging out in my grandparents' living room. Sexy, right? So we skipped theme song crowdsourcing last week, and I haven't had time to work on the next round this week. So I'm going to rerun the theme song bits from last time. And this time, guys, really, vote on it. This is not my theme song. This is your theme song. You need to make this happen. So I'm going to play the five pieces again that you can vote on. I'm just going to clip these straight out of what I did on episode 9. Ready? Here. Number one. It's time.
It's time.
For Josh figures it out. It's time.
It's time.
For Josh figures it out. Number two. What's this podcast about? Even I don't know. Come join me while I figure it out. Number three.
F-I-O-J-F-I-O-J-F-I-O-J-F-I-O-J-F-I-O.
Number four. You're listening to Josh Figures It Out with your reasonably well-informed host, Josh Richmond. Number five.
Want to know what the world's all about? So do I, you don't need to pout. At the very least, you don't have the gout, and you can listen to Josh Figures It Out.
How long can I stretch out the word number before it no longer sounds like number? Okay, I guess that did it. Now it just kind of sounds like an exaggerated mode. So guys, at Radio TFB on Twitter, vote, and then once you get your votes, there's only one round left, and then we're gonna have a finished theme song that's gonna kick off every week of this podcast. How exciting would that be? Theme song, studio, guests, it's all happening. So with that business out of the way, let's dive into what's Josh been up to this week. Making a note to myself here to add some chimes after that. Here, let's do that again with some chimes. What's Josh been up to this week? Yeah. Okay. Let's do this. What's Josh been up to this week? I, as usual, applied to like a million jobs. Not even hyperbole. That comes out to like more than 100,000 jobs a day. It's like 4,000 jobs an hour. Yeah, that sounds about right. Also assuming I don't sleep. I'm just a job application machine. And a little bit of progress for a couple of them. I got to round two of one job. I'm not going to say where, but these guys are not fucking around. I found out I got to round two of the screening process by email, and then the next day, I got sent a link for a half-hour combination psychological and cognitive test. Jesus Christ. So the cognitive, I'm pretty sure I killed. I mean, that stuff is right up my alley. It's, you know, just, it's like, it's little logic puzzles. It's things like which picture comes next in the sequence. A little bit of math, a little bit of kind of basic analogies. I do puzzles like that for fun. The personality test is, you know, they say there are no wrong answers. It's like 50 questions of the type, like, Do you strongly agree, strongly disagree, or sometimes agree, sometimes disagree for each of these statements? Like, I easily get angry. I'm a take charge kind of person. I always get my work completed on time. Now, besides the temptation to, you know, to make yourself look good, like, what do you say to I always get my work completed on time? Are you going to say agree or strongly agree? I mean, I usually get my work completed on time. So if I say strongly agree, is that lying for those couple of times I don't? Or what do you do with something like sometimes I feel depressed? I mean, it's true that sometimes I feel depressed, but you worry that, like, if you mark strongly agree on a test like that, they're going to think, oh, God, this guy is like a moody basket case. I think personality tests are a little bit BS in general. I've always enjoyed taking them, taking, like, the Myers-Briggs tests that give you four initials that are supposed to sum up your personality type. But the problem is, I can take that test, like, three times and get three different results. Sometimes I'm an INTP, sometimes I'm an INTJ, sometimes I'm an INFP. INN stay pretty constant, but sometimes just you feel like you're just a different personality on a different day, and it doesn't mean you're lying. So you want to make sure you're the personality that is most likely to get hired for that job, except you're not supposed to be thinking of that, you're supposed to just answer honestly. I drive myself in circles with this stuff. I wish it was more like questions of correct answers. I can do math problems. Math problems are easy. So that was that, and then a couple of days later, I got a phone call from them saying, hey, so we understand that you've applied for this position. Do you have some time right now to answer a couple questions? And of course, you want to say yes, so I say yes, and they go straight into, okay, tell me a little bit about yourself. Where do you see yourself in 5 years? Now, you know, I know phone interviews are a thing, and if it was a scheduled phone interview, I would have been 100% prepared, but this was just cell phone rings, and a minute later, dive straight in to tell me about yourself, and I wasn't totally prepared, and I felt like I kind of blew my answers. The ambush interview is, I guess, a more and more common technique for job interviewing these days, and it's a scary thing. The idea being, I guess, they want to see how you think on the spot. They want to see how well you can handle yourself under sudden pressure. I don't think I'm the kind of person who usually chokes under pressure. I'm really not. But you catch me on a bad day in a bad moment, and I think maybe I was distracted by something else in that moment and not in job interview mode, and I could give you really good answers to those questions if I had a little bit of time to think about it. But anyways, I know that's not realistic, so as soon as I got off the phone and, like, hung up and was like, damn it, what the, and kind of going into self-hatred mode, I instead decided to do a proactive thing. I looked up the 20 most common job interview questions, the things like, where do you see yourself in 5 years, and what is your greatest strength, what's your greatest weakness, and I just decided to write down my answers to those questions. Now, if I get a call out of the blue from any employer who wants to talk about that stuff, I am prepared. I've at least thought through these answers a little bit. With luck, I'd be near my computer and I could just kind of look at it to refresh myself. Point is, that's taking what could be a cloud or a dark moment and turning it into a growing opportunity, a learning experience. Instead of thinking, shit, I screwed up my chance at that job, it's thinking, okay, now I am more prepared for the next job interview, which might be the one. Besides that, yep, I'm at my grandparents' house. I'm watching another dog. Nothing against Charlie, but this one is slightly easier to deal with. Charlie seemed to just want to attack me and constantly lick my hand. This one is cool just hanging out. This one likes getting her belly rubbed. I'll rub her belly. It's not a big deal. And then she's just kind of chilling. Hanging out a little bit, sleeps on bed with me, but mostly wants to do her own thing. And then I'm hanging out at this house, my grandparents' house that he grew up in, Both my mom and my dad are no longer living in the houses that I grew up in as a kid. This is basically the closest thing I have to a childhood home now, and there's, you know, pictures of me all over the place, and it's a major nostalgia trip. I've been in a very reflective mood lately, which I think is natural. You know, when I first graduated from college, and a couple months later I got that internship with SiriusXM, I kind of figured to myself, okay, it's a 3-month internship, I'll do it, I'll get a little bit of good experience for my resume, and then I'll start applying for more jobs, figure out what my next move is. kind of just seeing it as an odd little detour I was taking before the next stage of my life happened. As it turned out, that odd little detour didn't take 3 months, it took 6 years. But it's still the same feeling of almost kind of being transported back to that directly post-college era of, okay, so that little detour ended, now what? I guess it's me really realizing this is a transitional moment in my life and just trying to contextualize it, trying to figure out where it goes in my life story. I thought it was going one way, and now I'm realizing it is in fact going to go in a totally different direction. I'm just looking around, exploring, cutting through the fog, figuring out what direction that is. And sometimes to do that, it helps to figure out what your narrative has been to this point and kind of look backwards as a little bit as well as forwards. And I'm looking forwards too, and I'm working my ass off. I'm trying to cut out fast food for reals. I've done a pretty good job of that this week. And I don't mean all fast food. I mean basically not eating McDonald's or KFC and Jack in the Box, instead eating like Jersey Mike's, Korean barbecue from the place down the street. Not exactly eating good for me, but it's less processed food. Because I heard that a lot of processed food can have a serious effect on your mood, and I'm trying to, you know, keep my edge. So I think that's helping me keep my edge, and it's helping me kind of stay sharp, stay energetic. It's not like I'm doing any sort of dramatic change to my diet, more just thinking a little bit more about exactly what the food I'm putting into my body is. And I got the studio set up. I'm getting my bathroom ceiling fixed. I'm maybe getting some good photos taken of me that I could put on my website to start making my website looking professional. Lots of things moving. So that's what's up with me. Let's talk Oscars. Now, the Oscars are bullshit, and everybody knows it. You find a different reason why they're bullshit every year, and this year it's the fact that Inside Llewyn Davis wasn't even considered one of the 9 best films of the year. Come on, guys. Come on. How out of touch do you have to be? It's not even like the Oscars have an anti-Cohen bias, you know? No Country for Old Men won Best Picture not that long ago. True Grit got nominated, and True Grit is totally lesser Coens. For them to just ignore Inside Llewyn Davis for what seems like no good reason? But it's fun to watch the Oscars. And it's fun to bet on the Oscars. So that's what we're going to do here. As I do every year, I will give you guys my rundown for who I think is going to win in every Oscar category. If you disagree, you can play along with me, because I will be live tweeting the Oscars and giving you guys my running tally. But I'm marking down my votes now. They're not going to change after this podcast is released. I'm putting my foot down. I'm sticking my flag in the ground. I'm saying, this is what it's going to be. And I think last year I got like 2/3 right. I can do better than that. This year I'm predicting a complete sweep. I'm getting every one of these right. So if you want to win your local Oscar pool, stick with me, kid. You just might learn something. Best Picture. Around the turn of the new year, I really thought this was going to be American Hustle. It seemed like such an Oscar bait movie. With the pop songs and just the Scorsese aping and the fact that it's definitely one of the most fun movies out of the ones nominated, I thought it was just going to be sweeping these Oscars. But it's gotten a lot of backlash. There have been a lot of people who have come out and said they hate American Hustle, which I really don't get. I mean, I could see you thinking it's not as deep as some of the other nominees. I agree, but it's just a fun movie. The production design is so much fun, and the performances are so much fun. Anyways, it's lost so much heat at this point that it's clear it's either going to be 12 Years a Slave or it's going to be Gravity. And it's, so you're just deciding whether the Academy is going to go for the proven hit that stars Sandra Bullock or the really serious movie about a tragedy in American history. They've gone both ways in the past. This year, my gut is saying, just like those ubiquitous 12 Years a Slave, 4-year consideration ads around LA, with the tagline, it's time. I think it probably is indeed time for 12 Years a Slave. I've said my issues of 12 Years a Slave on this podcast, but I definitely think it's the kind of movie that people are more likely to vote for Best Picture than actually enjoy watching. It's definitely a Schindler's List. However, Best Director is a different story, The conventional wisdom used to be that picture and director would go to the same movie. But in recent years, that has not been the case at all. It's, in fact, more likely to split. And all the buzz is around Alfonso Cuarón, and I think it's because the directing in Gravity is just so evident. That movie is, like, I mean, it's all about the directing and the cinematography and the visual experience. Best actor? It is just McConaughey's time. It's gotta be. I feel like if the Academy could give McConaughey an Oscar for True Detective, they would. It's just he's so hot right now, as Mugatu would say. McConaughey's gotta take it. I didn't even see Dallas Buyers Club. I heard he was good in it. I heard the movie was kind of problematic, but still. This is a case of less giving it to the role and more giving it to the man. The Academy wants McConaughey to have an Oscar. McConaughey is going to get his Oscar. Best Actress. Amy Adams seemed like she really might take it for a while, but again, the American Hustle backlash is sinking her chances. Cate Blanchett for Blue Jasmine seems like the front runner right now, but I'm predicting a backlash of a different kind. I think the Woody Allen backlash has really set in among a lot of people, especially after that article from Dylan Farrow pretty much called out Cate Blanchett specifically for giving, in Dylan's opinion, her molester father yet more accolades and yet more mentions on award shows. She took a lot of heat from that, and I think it's going to kill her actress chances. So this one is my big upset, but I'm calling it right here. Best actress this year goes to none other than Sandra Bullock in Gravity. Who I quite liked in Gravity, honestly. I didn't think of her performance was amazing, but yeah, she's the only character on screen most of the time. She's got to be the human analog in this big adventure story, and she carries it really well. I could easily see it going to her. I think the other nominees are too problematic this year, and Sandra is just kind of very universally beloved in Hollywood. I'm saying she takes it. Supporting actor. Here once again, I think this is a case of an Oscar going to the man as much as the role. But over the last few years, it seems like Michael Fassbender has gone from being considered a pretty good actor to considered like one of our best living actors. He's somebody who seems like he's overdue for an Oscar, frankly. And he's in 12 Years a Slave. He's monstrous in 12 Years a Slave. This award often goes to psychopaths. You know, think like Anton Chigurh. So I think Fassbender's got it. And supporting actress, Jennifer Lawrence. You know, J-Law's hot, but she's not that hot. I don't think she's hot enough to overcome the Hustle backlash. I think Lupita Nyong'o from, once again, 12 Years a Slave, who had just a brutal, heart-wrenching performance in that movie, too. I think she's got this one locked. I love the screenplay awards because they often go to the weirder nominees, the ones that don't get as much traction. For instance, Her, which was either my second or, at this point, probably was my favorite movie last year. What a screenplay. What a movie. I can't remember the last science fiction film that was done that well, executed that perfectly, and it all started with the screenplay. I think it's got to take original screenplay. It's the one place where it really could win. So I want to vote for it. An adapted screenplay? Look, this is the year for 12 Years a Slave. Sometimes it's a spread the love kind of year. Sometimes it just goes to a handful of movies. You're going to be hearing 12 Years a Slave and Gravity a lot as I run through these. As much as I'd like to see Before Midnight win adapted screenplay, first of all, it's kind of weird that it's adapted. It's a completely original story. And it's weird to think of it as a screenplay. I prefer to think of it as just, like, spontaneously erupting from the heads of Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy, even though I know that's not the case. Animated movie is pretty obvi. No Pixar this year means the Academy can finally reward a more traditional Disney musical, and it's gotta be Frozen. A lot of love for Frozen. Best foreign movie often goes to films that nobody's even heard about in the States yet. And a lot of people were talking about something called the Broken Circle Beatdown. So, sure, why not? Documentary. Best documentary feature is another choice between a fun one and a grueling one. You got 20 Feet from Stardom, which is, you know, the inspiring story of, like, industry backup singers and how they ended up on so many great records. And then you've got The Act of Killing, which is, you know, this horrific, grueling film about the perpetrators of the Indonesian genocide. This year, I think the Academy is leading towards Rod Gruelig. I'm going to give it to The Act of Killing. Production design. Usually it's real easy to vote for these. You just vote for the movie with the most production design. And when there's a Baz Luhrmann movie in the mix, you don't vote against that. Those are designed up the wazoo. What is a wazoo? I've always wondered. It's not gazoo, like the Great Gazoo, but it's something that you go up. Maybe it's like the name of a river. Like when you're going up the wazoo, it means you're going up the wazoo river. Plus, that movie was an actual hit, and Hollywood loves rewarding actual hits with Oscars, so I think The Great Gatsby is the winner here. Cinematography is the biggest gimme of the night. There's no way Emmanuel Lubezki is not winning cinematography for Gravity. I mean, that whole movie was... Of course, it's more complicated than that, too, because the lines between cinematography and editing and visual effects are definitely blurring, and in every frame of Gravity, you're seeing a combination of real footage shot by a camera and CGI footage created by the VFX team. And of course, the editing team is the guys who are assembling these two things together and making it look seamless. Which is why I predict Gravity is going to win on all three of those counts, cinematography, editing, and visual effects. Just because it's hard to separate one from the other, and it seems like the clear standout in all of those categories. American Hustle has to win something. It would be a little too embarrassing if it walked out with literally zero Oscars. And I think the field it clearly excelled in the most was in costume design. So I'm saying costumes is going to American Hustle. Makeup has to be Dallas Buyers Club, because the only two other options are The Lone Ranger and Jackass Bad Grandpa. And there's no way in hell the Lone Ranger's getting an Oscar. And sadly, there's no way in hell a Jackass movie is getting an Oscar. However deserving they are, I think it's got to be Dallas Buyers Club, because that's the only respectable movie on this list. Best score is a category near and dear to my heart. I studied film scoring a little bit in school. I feel like a great score can make a great movie almost all by itself sometimes. And a bad score can completely take you out of an otherwise engrossing movie. If the score feels like it's pushing the emotional beats too hard, I just think, oh, the score is doing all the work here. I think Gravity is probably the odds-on favorite here, but it's a place where I gotta vote with my heart, and I'm gonna vote for her. With a score created by The Arcade Fire and violinist Owen Pallett. And it's also just a fantastic, gorgeous, longing, sad, beautiful score. One of those scores that I really could listen to on its own, which I don't think I could say about the other nominees. Best song, it's another place I kind of like to give to her, because the Moon Song is beautiful and another song that's close to my heart. And it's also competing against Pharrell's Happy, which at this point is like a bona fide blockbuster single. I think it's number one on the iTunes charts this week. Both of those seem like they could win if it wasn't going up against Let It Go from Frozen. Like, Academy voters have been waiting so long to be able to vote for, like, a classic Disney musical hit in this category. That's, like, the quintessential best song winner. So now that they got one that people are really seeming to latch onto, there's no way it does not win. Sad for Pharrell. Sad for Karen O. I don't feel bad for you, too. They were never going to win anyways. And what was with that weird one that was, like, a nominee for, like, a week? There was apparently a best song nominee called Alone Yet Not Alone that only got in there because it was... I guess from a movie that was made by a friend of the Academy. Really sketchy stuff. Anyways, it got disqualified. Just goes to show you, you really can't vote on quality for these things. You just gotta vote on what you think this semi-corrupt organization is going to vote for. Quickly running through the rest, sound editing. Gravity. Totally deserving on that front. Way more deserving than for score. Sound mixing. Also Gravity. Even though Inside Llewyn Davis is nominated for the same category, the Academy inexplicably hates that movie, so it's Gravity. And then the short categories. I always vote for the one with the funny name. It's never failed me yet. So animated short goes to Room on the Broom, which I think must be about a lonely witch who's riding around on her broom, doing witch stuff, making potions, collecting Eye of Newt. But she's lonely. There's room on her broom. She wants to make it a broom for two. Documentary short. I'm going with The Lady in Number 6. Of course, this is a film about a lady who is trapped inside the circular part of a gigantic numeral 6. This is kind of a Saw-type scenario where, you know, there's some kind of, like, mathematical jigsaw figure. I'm imagining, like, maybe, probably looks like Rita Rabbit is making her solve math equations, and if she doesn't do it, she has to, like, saw off her hands and feet or something like that. And this is a documentary, which means that really happened. Who is this monster with the giant number 6? And then live-action short, I'm picking Do I Have to Take Care of Everything? This is a movie about, I think, a harried mom who, like, has kids running around, and they're constantly asking her for, like, help with their homework, or I broke the vase in the living room, or the cat's on fire, and she's taking care of all this stuff, and then her husband, like, comes in and says, honey, help me take the groceries from the car, and she sighs and says, do I have to take care of everything? And then the movie ends. It all builds up to that one punchline. Trust me, when you see it in theaters, it kills. So two things. I'm getting hungry. It's about 1:30 in the afternoon as I'm recording this, and I haven't eaten lunch. And I think it's making me a little bit lightheaded. I really wanted to get this whole thing recorded early so that I would have time to edit it later and post it tomorrow morning. But I probably should have skipped lunch for that. I think it might even be affecting my podcast performance. I don't know. So I should probably eat, and then also in half an hour, Abby's dog groomer comes. This is such a spoiled dog. Every 3 weeks, a dog groomer comes to the house to, to plump up Abby's fur and bathe her and make sure she's nice and fresh. This dog is living the life. And you know she gets two full, like, doggy treats a day, like big bones, too. This is a spoiled dog. I'm looking right at her as I'm saying this. You are a spoiled dog. You're a spoiled dog. But I'm gonna let her get her grooming on. So yeah, remember next week we're going to I'm gonna watch the Oscars. I'm gonna live tweet it, but I'm also on the next podcast. I'm gonna be breaking down the Oscars, and then after this, let's talk a little bit about net neutrality. Man, that's gonna be exciting. In the meantime, intermission over. Wow, this is the really nice thing about having my own home studio is I can, like, take a break, and it doesn't matter for you guys. I can just chill. I can, you know, make some lunch for myself. Abby's all groomed now. Her fur she literally looks like she's covered in shag carpet. It's really weird. But she looks very happy, happy and clean. This is a basic freedom. If I wanted to, I could record this thing like at a minute at a time over a period of weeks. I should try that. What would that be like if I recorded a minute of a podcast a day for like 60 days in a row? It might sound disjointed, or it might be like one of those videos where somebody takes a picture of themselves every day for like a year. You might be able to see my growth over a period of months. Or decay as I dissolve in some sort of downward spiral, or my glorious rise. I would like to think it's the latter, right? My rise to podcast supremacy! Take that, Mark Maron. WTF, GTFO. I actually don't like WTF that much, that's the truth. But that's a story for another time. What was I going to talk about? I have net neutrality. Right, oh yeah, well, if that doesn't get your motor running, I don't know what will. What an exciting topic. But it looks like we're not going to have to talk about it much longer, because it appears net neutrality is dead. After a deal that Netflix has signed with Comcast, basically Netflix paying ridiculous amounts of money to ensure that Comcast will keep Netflix's data stream steady. That anybody who wants to stream Netflix content will be able to get it smoothly with no hiccups. Now, if you don't know what net neutrality is, it's the idea. It's an idea that's been around really since the beginning of the internet. It's one of those foundational ideas that no provider of content gets priority over any other when it comes to the fiber optic infrastructure of the internet. Nobody gets priority access to the pipes. Nobody gets priority access to the series of tubes. Any website's data is as good as any other website's data, no matter where it came from. And the reason it's been possible to rise so quickly on the World Wide Web is because of this freedom of access to infrastructure. This is this deal is basically the first nail in the coffin of that freedom. The FCC had already kind of struck down some laws that made enforced net neutrality. But now this is the first deal of its kind that's ever been struck. The first deal where basically one content provider has struck a deal with a cable internet provider to ensure that everybody has steady access to that content. Now, Comcast is claiming that it's not breaking net neutrality because it's not prioritizing Netflix content. But in this case, I don't know what the difference is. Netflix is a big company, but especially in terms of data consumption, Netflix is ridiculously gigantic. Something like 30% of all data on the internet goes through Netflix. And this deal's gotten a lot of bad press, and Comcast, you know, it's very easy to demonize Comcast, and a lot of people are demonizing Comcast from this. But Netflix is the bad guy here, too. And I think people don't want to demonize Netflix as much because, you know, it's a cuddly service. It's a service that's near and dear to its users. It's something we all love. It's, only $7 a month and you can get all this stuff streamed to your computer. It's really convenient. Arrested Development Season 4, House of Cards, all this stuff. They have a face where Comcast doesn't really have a face. So I think we want to assume, oh, Netflix, they're on our side. They're the good guys. Comcast is the bad guys. But if you want to set yourself up as a competitive video provider to Netflix, this deal basically makes it impossible. This is an incredibly monopolistic play. It's basically saying that if you don't have the enormous cash reserves that Netflix has, you won't be able to ensure that access. Your access might be interrupted while Netflix gets it smooth and steady. So sure, other, you know, guys like Hulu will be able to play. Any other company trying to start a video provider that already has enormous amounts of cash will be able to play. But upstarts and new businesses are going to get squeezed out. And that's how the internet no longer becomes like a functioning marketplace of ideas. I don't want to sound like I'm some doomsayer, but in a sense, it really is an enormous change for the internet. Yes, the origins of the internet were military-funded, ARPANET and so on, so it's not exactly totally clean, but in many ways, the internet did rise out of these hippie utopian ideals. You know, Stuart Brand and the Whole Earth Catalog and the Well, Wikipedia all this stuff if you don't know what I'm talking about. But the internet was founded on this concept of being like a community for the free exchange of ideas and information. And that's still a huge part of its value today, especially in like developing countries around the world where revolutions are happening. But now that the internet is not just big business, it's kind of all business, you know, big money has moved in and take it over. And the Age of Aquarius is dawning, and the winners of the Age of Aquarius appear to be, once again, entitled billionaires. New bosses, same as the old bosses. And I'm thinking here about another article I was just reading about. It's an article about a recent speech at a fundraiser given by Peter Thiel, the co-founder of PayPal, one of the first major investors in Facebook, and like a hardcore libertarian political advocate. And he gave a speech where he said that he feels like this country is demonizing technology. Here's some quotes from this article. "I defy you to name one science fiction film, with the possible exception of Star Trek and Back to the Future, in which technology is not portrayed as destructive. The tech industry is an easy scapegoat in this country. People are looking for an excuse to beat up on technology." Which, I don't really know if that's true. I mean, I don't know exactly what attitudes are like in the Midwest or the South, but here in Los Angeles, it seems like we are in the middle of a culture-wide love affair with technology. We're glued to our phones, we're glued to our laptops. But then Thiel kept talking, and he talked about how in this country, inequality and wealth has widened dramatically to the point where you really wonder if we're living in a stable society at all, which I agree with him with. And then he goes on to argue that the reason we have all this inequality in this country is because of the regulatory system, saying the regulatory burden is higher in this country, the court system is much more onerous, the zoning regulations are more severe. And if you let Thiel and other entrepreneurs just do their thing, create more jobs, then there would be less inequality, which is an insane and completely false argument. He even said, I wouldn't mind paying more taxes if I thought the government knew how to spend money. Saying this less than a week after the corporation in which he's a major investor, Facebook, spent $19 billion on WhatsApp, which is a messaging service. It's not that popular here in the United States. It is very popular around the world. One of the fastest growing messaging services, and not necessarily a bad acquisition for Facebook, but $19 billion? It's not even necessarily that kind of move would work out badly for Facebook. It could easily work out in their favor. They could make their $19 billion back if WhatsApp is a big enough hit. But that doesn't mean they know how to spend $19 billion and the government doesn't. First of all, it's very likely they could have spent a lot less and still managed to acquire WhatsApp. But no matter what, even if Facebook makes their money back, even if it is justifiable in a business sense to spend $19 billion this way, it doesn't mean that's the best way to $19 billion could be spent in this country. It's not about just the United States amassing gross wealth. It's not about just maximizing the gross national product. It's about raising the standard of living for the most people. $19 billion could do so much for so many people. It could single-handedly lift an enormous chunk of families in this country out of poverty. Instead, it's going into the pockets of, like, 50 people. The amount of people who work for WhatsApp, they have a staff of about 50. That's who's getting this. And this is what happens when you let entrepreneurs run the show. That's what happens when you let business people make all the decisions. They'll make decisions that make sense in a business sense, that makes sense in a just maximizing the total amount of dollars we have as a country sense, but it does nothing about inequality. And there's no way that reducing regulations, cutting government funds for these programs, would not create more poor people. Corporations don't care about labor. And especially tech corporations. I'm the last person in the world who's going to demonize tech. But the fact is, tech companies need less people to create wealth. Facebook was able to become Facebook with a very small amount of people. Thiel's argument is essentially that we don't need the welfare state. That if we take people off welfare and instead put that money in the hands of businessmen to create jobs, then there will just be more jobs in this country. But that's not what happens in practice. In practice, the corporations just get more money, but they're not creating jobs. And particularly because of the way tech businesses operate, I think we need non-employment-based alternatives in place for people. Because this isn't a problem that's going to get easier. This is a problem that's getting tougher by the day. Technology is, slowly but implacably rendering labor totally irrelevant. With every advance we make in productivity, every time we create a robot that can do the work of 100 or 1,000 or 10,000 men, we're raising the standard of living for people, and we're making technological progress, but we are eliminating jobs. And we're not creating new jobs faster than that. And as AI gets stronger and stronger, we are going to get to a place where most labor can be automated. We may even get to a point in human history where jobs, as we know them, are unnecessary. Where the majority of people in this country don't have jobs, and we don't need them to have jobs. That's an entirely new paradigm, and that's scary to people. When 100 years from now, when they write the history textbooks about the 21st century, they're going to call this era something like the digital revolution. Basically, my lifespan. I was born in 1986. My life is the digital revolution. I'm about equally as old as the World Wide Web. When I was 4 or 5, I remember a friend coming over to my dad's, and he was checking out something called Prodigy, which had this amazing ability to send electronic mail, like lightning fast, across the world. And I remember my dad saying, What's the point of that? Why not just be able to send, like, a normal letter? The internet was in its infancy around the same time I was in my infancy. A few years after that, I got my first AOL account. I downloaded my first shareware program. I'm pretty sure it was a clone of Breakout. I thought, I can't believe I just got this game for free. This is amazing. Why isn't everything available online for free? Little did I know. When I became a teenager, right around the same time Napster became big. So around the same time I was going through my rebellious anti-authoritarian phase, the internet was going through it too. My freshman year of college, only like a couple months into my freshman year of college, I was got a link sent to me saying that I should sign up for this brand new site called Facebook, which was just brand new available in my school. It had just come to UC Santa Cruz. I was one of the first people to sign up for Facebook. And my adulthood has basically coincided with the onset of Web 2.0 and the internet moving away from computers and onto tablets and phones and devices and Wi-Fi becoming a thing and social media taking over everything. The internet has been my constant companion growing alongside me my entire life. And I was hot on it. I think I was in high school also when I created my first GeoCities website. I bought my first domain name. And I think that, and I thought to myself, this is an amazing technology. We haven't even begun to tap the potential of this, and I still think we haven't quite tapped the potential of the internet. I still think people don't even realize how big of a change this is in human history. It's an industrial revolution-sized change. Seemingly anything is possible digitally, and that's liberating, but it's daunting in equal measure. The industrial revolution was a turning point in human history because it showed for the first time humans taking control of the planet with tools. We could mass produce things. We weren't really subject to the whims of nature anymore after that. We had taken control of the world. But the digital revolution is in many ways about us losing control of our tools. It's kind of, we're finding humanity's tools are taking control of us. We're getting to the point where our technology is starting to outpace us and do things we as humans couldn't dream of. And that's why I've started noticing a trend over the last couple of years. And maybe this is a little bit what Peter Thiel was talking about, but a trend away from technology. And not in the Luddite sense of, like, smash your phone, smash your computers, but a sense of valuing things that are non-digital, of valuing the human and the organic and the real. It's showing up in simple ways, things like the rise of handwriting. I've noticed a huge growth in handwritten art, hand-drawn art. You know, even the movie Her kind of poked fun at this whole idea with these computer-generated handwritten letters. But that, and, you know, and crafts on Etsy, and a cappella music, you know, things that can be done simply with the human voice. And yeah, and music, definitely a trend towards more organic sounds. You know, turn of the decade, 2010, 2011, it was all maxed out, super compressed, computer-generated sounds. But now, pop hits have not real instruments, but sounds that sound like real instruments. I mean, you know, we're not getting, like, lo-fi, we're not getting guided by voices or anything, but that's been done. And also, it's easily faked. It's very easy to create a fake lo-fi recording on high-quality instruments. What I'm really just talking about is this impulse to create and share something real, realizing that while we can create anything using digital devices, as a species, we also need to take stock and decide what parts of the pre-digital world we think are worth preserving. I ultimately think digital is... it's an incredible thing. I'm not anti-progress. I think it's an empowering thing. Like I said, I think it is the story of my generation. But it doesn't mean that everything digital is an unambiguous good and everything pre-digital is an unambiguously bad. And we have to realize if we are losing something in this transition, what do we want to lose and what do we want to try to keep? And this leads pretty cleanly into my new music segment, which I'm actually going to start this time, switch it up. I'm going to start with my pick of the month. I'm going to talk about all sorts of releases from the month of February, but I want to start with my definite favorite record of the year so far. It's by an artist named Sun Kil Moon, which is basically a pseudonym for the singer Mark Kozelek. He used to be known as Red House Painters in the 90s. But he released an album called Benji a few weeks ago. I've been following Kozelek's work for a while. He's a veteran. He's 47 years old, singer-songwriter. Very much came up in the indie wave of just guys with guitars singing sad songs in the 90s. And I think he's made some really interesting songs. He's done some really interesting work. There's a lot of great Red House Painters material that you should check out. But the issue I've always had with him is he tends to paint in a single color. He's got a very sad voice, and he writes very sad songs. And there's kind of this unmistakable air of melancholy about him at all times. And that can be exhausting to listen to for more than a couple songs at a time. Funnily enough, Kozelek admits as much on this album. He has like a whole 10-minute song about how he's just always been a melancholy person, and no matter what, he's never been able to break the spell. And he makes the admission kind of moving and kind of funny. And on this album, it's not as straight up sad, sad, sad as his previous albums. There are funny moments here. There are moments of levity, even if they're not like funny, funny. They're definitely not something you're gonna like laugh at most of the time. And in terms of just being a guy with a guitar, the first time I heard this record, I definitely thought, oh great, it's just a song after song of a guy strumming his guitar and singing. But the more you listen, the less samey the production sounds, and you start picking up on all these little flourishes, the way that some songs have a certain type of backing vocal, or some songs have the way some songs incorporate percussion. It's not just a guy with a guitar record. It's a lot closer to Modest Mouse circa The Moon in Antarctica.
The other night I went and saw the postal service. Ben's my friend, but getting there was the worst. Trying to park and getting up the hill and finding a spot amongst the drunk kids staring at their cells. Standing at the back of the crowd of 8,000. Thought of Ben when I met him in 2000 at a festival in Spain. He was on the small stage then and I didn't know.
And on a musical level, this album is quite pretty and it's very well recorded. But what makes this album special is the lyrical approach. On this record, on Benji, Kozelek has renounced the idea of speaking in metaphors. No vague lyrics about sunsets and broken mirrors and just imagery that could refer to whatever. I think he felt that obscured his points and obscured what he wanted to say, so he replaced the metaphors with details. Tons of details, little tiny references scattered throughout. You know, the album Benji is named after the time he references in a song where he saw the movie Benji with his grandma. Or he'll talk about eating blue crab cakes, going to Red Lobster, going to a postal service show. And all these details paired with plain, bald sentiments about, like, a song's about how much he loves his mom and loves his dad, or a song about how awful Newtown was. Or there's one, like, incredible song where he just names every woman he's ever kissed or loved or fucked. Or a song about his cousin who died in this terrible tragedy. Or just a song about, like, going to Panera Bread. I'll read you a sample lyric from the song I Love My Dad, which is a song about exactly that. Here's one of the stanzas. When I was 5, I came home from kindergarten, crying because they sat me next to an albino. My dad said, son, everyone's different. You gotta love them all equally. And then my dad sat me down. He said, you gotta love all people, pink, red, black, or brown. And then just after dinner, he played me the album They Only Come Out at Night by Edgar Winter. So that's such an unusual song verse. And it's not poetry. It's prose, basically. And it's not like I can personally relate to any of those details. I've never known any albino kids. I never listened to that album, but it's like I feel like I'm there. I feel like I'm part of that conversation. I feel that emotional connection. And I feel like he is trying to make something real.
Son, everyone's different. You gotta love them all equally, you know. My dad sat me down. He said, you gotta love all people. Pink, red, black, or brown. And then just after dinner, he played me the album They Only Come I'm Out at Night by Edgar Wynn.
This is Kozelek's attempt to make just a boldly human statement. And it's one of the most affecting records I've ever heard. And the sound of the record is very organic, very much, you know, in the vein of real instruments being recorded, very much a guy and his guitar is the center. But the sentiment is very digital age. The idea that I'm going to throw my thoughts about the world out there and just hope it resonates with someone. Somewhere. And I can, for obvious reasons, really relate to that. So absolutely check out Benji by Sunkill Moon. It's I won't say it's an easy listen, but it's not an uneasy listen either. It's just it's engrossing and fascinating and deeply moving.
Michaeline, Michaeline. Michaeline, 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 she wanna love like anyone else. Michaeline, 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 she had dreams like anyone else. My friend Brett, he likes to play the guitar.
That's my pick for February, but there's been some other interesting February releases, and let's talk new music a little bit. Let me run through some of the more other interesting albums that you may have missed from the last couple weeks. Let's talk about Les Claypool's new album.
You can tell by the way I use my walk, I'm a woman's man, no time to talk. Music loud and women warm, I've been kicked around since I was born. When it's all right, it's okay, you can look the other way.
This release is credited to Les Claypool's duo de twang. It's called 4 Foot Shack, and I've always had a weakness for novelty covers. And this whole album kind of sticks to that very bass heavy. Les Claypool playing some excellent bass. That kind of oompa oompa weird backwoods sound. A lot of Primus covers and a couple other oddballs. I think that's this Staying Alive cover is absolutely perfect, and I love it. Not the only veteran oddball who's released a record in the last month. What about Fetus? The album Soak by Fetus is fucking insane. I mean, not that I would expect any less from this guy. You may know him, he's been making music under various variations on the Fetus name for a long time, and he's also done the score for the Venture Brothers, which is where I first discovered him. He's got a great sense of orchestration, but some of his albums can be slower and more experimental. This is the Fetus sound I like best, when he's in this kind of schizo genre hopping mode and throwing everything but the kitchen sink in there. It's like Mike Patton fronting Oingo Boingo. It's insane. Container is an interesting new electronic producer who released the Adhesive EP. This is an interesting sound, and it's kind of the inverse of the sound that Black Dice popularized about a decade ago, which was Black Dice. They were, you know, they were fixtures in the New York noise scene, and they started out with just pure amorphous noise, but made headway by adding a beat to it, a very simplistic beat, and creating this kind of techno noise hybrid. And I think Container's coming at it from the opposite direction, where they're starting with just a solid rhythm, a solid techno rhythm, but amplifying it and really noising it up and giving it just sick levels of distortion. I think it's a great production style, and I imagine it would just kill in a club setting too. What about the new self-titled mixtape from Black Portland? I kind of hope Black Portland is like right next to White Portland. I imagine their sister cities in the middle of Oregon. Actually, I don't wish that. That's basically segregation. That's like the equivalent of having black water fountains. That should not be. I'm going to instead imagine it's some parallel universe, mostly black version of Portland. The breakout star of this duo is Young Thug, who's gotten a lot of attention in the last couple of years for his unique flow and his unique way of spitting. And I think on this one, he's finding himself twisting his flow into some real hooks. I love the track we just played, Danny Glover. I think it's great. And the whole album is free online. Young Thug and Bloody J's Black Portland. This band is just symbols. It's three crosses. I think the band is called Crosses.
Look around through the town, not a soul to be found. In silence, not a sound. There's no one around but you. In the back of the car, on our way from the bar. In silence, here we are. Reminding us how we do. We'll get set. It's time we come to the end.
So yes, that was Chino Moreno of the Deftones as the front man there, and I love the Deftones, but here's the analogy I'll make. This is to Deftones as Fort Minor is to Linkin Park, which is to say, this is pretty damn weak sauce. God, hard to listen to. Chino Moreno is capable of a lot more than this. Let's move on to something better, like I think this has been out for more than a month even, but should not be overlooked, the new Against Me record.
Making yourself up as you go along. Who's gonna take you home tonight? Who's gonna take you home? Who's gonna take you home tonight? Who's gonna take you home? 'Cause God bless your transsexual heart.
That is Against Me with Transgender Dysphoria Blues. As many of you listeners probably know, the singer of Against Me, Laura Jean Grace, came out as transsexual a little over a year ago. Still sounds exactly the same, still sounds like a dude, but doesn't really change her story. And she's a great singer, and you know, the story behind the album is great, and it's cool that she's exploring her sexuality and her identity in this way. But the songwriting is even better than the story. It's been great listening to Against Me just continue to mature and evolve as pop songwriters of the last few albums. They are kind of far from their punk roots at this point, but at the same time, doing a record about being a transgendered person in America is kind of a punk rock move. What about the new Untold record called Blacklight Spiral? This might be the weirdest record of the bunch. Nah, actually, Fetus is weirder. It beats it on the weird scale. But this is a great, really cool record. Untold started as a dubstep artist in the UK, but this is going genuinely post-dubstep by, in my opinion, removing the step equation and just kind of going full dub. Some great work with delay effects and repeating samples and using it to create a unique soundscape. Taking dubstep sounds away from the clubs and moving it into the realm of pure sonic experimentation is something I can definitely get behind. Finally, I'm still giving this one a shot. I haven't had a chance to listen to it much, but check out the new record from Angel Olsen. So this one is called Burn Your Fire for No Witness by Angel Olsen. I don't know much about this songwriter. She's operating in kind of a indie country, I guess they would have called it alt-country mode. I read a great write-up that Carl Wilson did in Slate, comparing her and Lydia Loveless and a couple other modern young alt-country artists. And I think it's solid. Some of the songs seem a little bit underdeveloped, but she's got a really interesting voice. She gives the lyrics some great readings and some great inflections, and it's great to listen to. I was going to read you guys some more bad high school poetry, but I think I'm going to save that for next episode, because I have a feeling this is already running really long. Like, really long. So we have one more thing to talk about, which is, of course, as always, True Detective. Episode 6 was called Haunted Houses, and it premiered last Sunday. And it's continuing the 2002 story arc started last episode and really almost taking us all the way to the present. It seems like a lot of the loose ends of how we got to 2012 Rust and 2012 Marty have kind of been worked out at this point. The online chatter seems to be this episode is a step down from the last one, and I mean, I guess how could it not be, because the last episode was so fantastic? There's no way this could compete on just a structural level. But there's some really cool, really great moments here. We should start with the controversial bit, though, which is how they treated the character of Maggie in this episode. I should say first, I think Michelle Monaghan has done a fantastic job as Maggie. She's a great actress, and the differences between her closed-off self around Marty and her closed-off self in the future, and then the way she becomes this just open wound, this open, vulnerable person around Rust is really, really well played. And I agree the character is a little thinly sketched, because all the non-Rust and Marty characters in the show are thinly sketched, and it's the reality of True Detective. This is a show about men doing men things and exploring what it means to be a man and different views on manliness and masculinity. And so I think, and that's justifiable. There's plenty of shows about women being women, too. There's plenty of shows that have genuine gender parity, and True Detective doesn't necessarily have to be one of those shows. And it's not like she's not justified in finding sex away from her cheating douchebag asshole husband, Marty, who we see just beating the shit out of some high school kids at the beginning of this episode, as if he could not become more unlikable. And of course, justifying it as a man has to pay a man's price, which doesn't mean anything. That means nothing. But the Maggie and Rust seduction scene. Okay, so I saw Maggie and Rust hooking up from pretty much the first moment they met. But the way it played out and the way they made it seem like their hookup was something she was doing to him, as if she'd come up with some ulterior motive to drive Rust and Marty apart, so she basically turned into a cartoon femme fatale, seduced Rust, and then like immediately as soon as the sex is over and he's like realizing, oh my god, what have you done to me, get the fuck out of here, and then her going back to Marty and just spitefully telling him, yeah, I did it, I fucked Rust, and I haven't been fucked like that since the girls. Nice line. But basically they're turning her into Alexandra Daddario's character, Lisa. They're just turning her into some shrew who's out to destroy the lives of the men who wrong her. Some manipulative wench. And I think that is kind of a misogynist take on the character. It's not, you know, a lot of this show has been just depicting misogyny, but this is different. I think that actually is a misogynist moment for True Detective. And there's a moment where Maggie has some self-awareness where she's like, yeah, I almost fucked that stranger at a bar. I think that's really the way the character should have gone. Just, she feels so alone, she needs some emotional release. Not, I'm going to tear apart Rust and Marty's partnership because of what this guy did to me. I didn't love that angle. It's weird that I keep seeing people online describing the sex scene as ugly and de-eroticized, though, because what does it say about me that I thought that sex scene was like insanely hot? It was so intense. They just like these two people meeting on this animal level, and damn. I don't know. Maybe I'm fucked up. Anyway, all that was just a piece of this episode, which felt a little bit less structured and more piecemeal than previous episodes, but a lot of the individual pieces worked like gangbusters. I'm thinking of like that big interrogation scene with the Munchausen by proxy mom, and Rust just seeming so calm and so controlled, and but kind of honestly disgusted at the same time, and gets the confession out of her, it's slowly dawning on you what this woman has done, and then ends it with him just saying, "Babe, guess what? If you get the opportunity, you should kill yourself." I mean, shit, that is harsh. The Lovecraftian existential horror angles were getting played up in this episode a lot too. Another mention of some 17th century mystic that a priest was hiding child porn in. Going to the victim who was locked in Reggie Ledoux's shed from last episode. Going back to her and her screaming freak out, where she's going, his face, and screaming. And that scream completely struck me as like a reaction to that kind of existential horror, like as if she had looked into the abyss of evil. And more comparisons of the difference between Marty and Rust and how society views them. You know, Maggie talks about Rust as a man with integrity, though he certainly has his own kind of psychotic behavior, and he is a person who's prone to see conspiracies where there may not be conspiracies. I'm not totally sold on the whole Billy Lee Tuttle thing either. But Marty is the one with psychotic anger issues. And maybe it's just because it's he's angry for more socially acceptable reasons, like finding out your daughter was screwing some guys or your wife's been screwing around. Doesn't make it justifiable, but I guess it makes it understandable enough to people that he is the one who's allowed to keep his job and eventually get promoted, while Rust is the one who's actually doing all the work and actually gets burned in the end. My current crazy conspiracy theory, by the way, is that T-Mobile girl who seduced Marty, and was that like deliberate T-Mobile branding? Does T-Mobile just want to associate their brand with hot girls? Is that their thing? Because it's smart. But I think that girl, she approached Marty, and she's basically sucking Marty in. And I think she may be another one of these shows, manipulative women. In this case, I have a feeling she's connected, or she's like some sort of accomplice to the whole Tuttle conspiracy. Like she's reeling Marty into this world, because we know that she was on like the Bunny Ranch we saw earlier. We know the Bunny Ranch is connected to the Tuttle schools in some way, but we don't know exactly how. I've got a feeling. Just call it that much. But so many more details, so many more mysteries. That Rust's girlfriend, who we saw for like 20 seconds, she's got to come back, right? It's, I, all these little details, and I love the mystery of it. And I think it's an expertly structured mystery, but it's not like watching Zodiac. It's not like this mystery that you're trying to piece together along with Jake Gyllenhaal. It's not a puzzle that you're trying to solve. It's almost a mystery that derives its power from being a mystery. In the sense that that the Yellow King that Rust is chasing isn't a person at all, or is it may not even be a group of people. It's a force of nature. It might even be human nature itself. And you could make the argument that on True Detective, human nature is the true enemy. On that note, I think that wraps up True Detective in a nicely philosophical way. Only two episodes left of this shit. Holy crap. I've talked way too long. I've got to end this. Don't forget to check out everything I'm doing at Radio TFB on Twitter. Don't forget to, if you're listening to this thing, man, give me feedback. Let me know how I'm doing. Let me know if you're enjoying it. Even if it's just as simple as, great job, Josh. You don't even know how much a tweet like that means to me. Those are the kind of tweets that make me want to keep doing this and keep making this thing better and better. So do that and review this show on iTunes and tell your friends about it. I understand that this isn't necessarily the easiest podcast to dive into from the first episode, considering that so much of the first couple episodes dealt with, like, Ellis fallout and found me finding my feet. But have them listen to one of the more recent ones. I think I've been doing some really solid episodes as of late, so there might be some good starter ones in there. Or just tweet me to say, hey, at Radio TFP. I've been upping my Twitter output. I'm sure you've noticed. I'm friendly. I'll talk to you. I can't think of anything else, so I'm going to end this, wrap it up, and edit this shit in time to drop it for your Wednesday morning consumption, so you can get over that hump. Until next time, this is Josh. Catch you guys on the flip side. Ciao.